Very nice to be here, colleagues, and like some others, I've probably got too much material, so some of it will go through a bit fast, but let's see how we go. They always say it's not good to start with an apology, it makes people feel anxious, but I know you're with me. And I've got the big topic of dealing with issues around risk, which we're seeing and risk anxiety a lot in our daily practice. But I'm also trying to get to the big subject of social pedagogy and what it is bringing to some British workplaces where it's coming in and maybe helping us overcome some very risk-averse practices. So I'm trying to draw quite a big map here of connections between some quite big themes. So let's see how we go. So there's a wider context here. In society generally, there's much talk of the general sense of increased anxiety and the sense in which authorities and powers that be try to manage risk. And I'm not going to try and talk about it because it would require a whole lecture, but Ulrich Beck, a German sociologist, is the person who first put this down, talking about risk society. And so the issues we're struggling with here, which is really the bottom point on this screen, is the fact that risk-averse practices, as I would call them, and I think it's been well accepted, are coming in to daily care in children's homes and similar places in ways that sometimes are quite absurd. And I'm trying to understand, why is this happening? Why are people doing things that seem so crazy and absurd and risk-averse? And I'm trying to understand that, and I think I do need to look to this wider background. And also, I want you to know that those of us in this room, because many of us have shared frustrations about this, sort of things that you can't do in a children's home now or with children in residential care, or you have to get permissions or do risk assessments for crossing the road and this kind of stuff. Again, it's not just care or child care, residential care. Social work generally, some writers are saying the whole of the social work profession is being overwhelmed by a risk focus. So that's the wider background here. Just to back that up, this slide shows two quotations from writers who Hazel Kemshall, English writer, has written a lot about the emergence of risk. And she has said, acknowledging in some areas this is very important. You know, if we're dealing with sex offenders, for example, a very high profile and troubling issue, then you have to risk manage, you know, and social workers are properly concerned with risk issues. But she and also folks who are quoted in the second point are just saying that there doesn't seem to be any boundary of this risk management approach. It's overwhelming everything. And she even says that risk has become the dominant raison d'etre, the purpose of personal social services, central to everything. And this has just somehow happened. There is no law passed that said this should happen. There's no policy document that says social workers must become obsessed about risk. It's just happened. And that's a very troubling thing when your whole profession gets pushed in a direction that nobody within the profession has put their hands up and said, let's do this. People have kind of done it because somehow there's this feeling we ought to do it. So that's what's driven my curiosity about all this. Not going to spend much time on this, just nailing down the point that if we continue to practice in these ways of carrying out risk assessments over very trivial things, and workers feeling they can't do things spontaneously because they need someone's permission, we couldn't go to the beach, we need to get parental signatures for a day trip. The focus of my talk here is about outdoor activities particularly, and that's what's at the core of this strand of thinking. Obviously, it could apply in different areas, but for frontline workers, direct services, our American colleagues say, we're seeing this tremendous disruption of what was seen as normal practice. You know, let's take a group of kids and go to a park somewhere and play a kick a ball about, oh, have we risk assessed that park? Has it been checked? Is it okay? Go to the beach on a sunny day. It don't happen very often in Scotland. We need to seize the moment. I can't really do that. You'd need to get a form home to the parents. And a lot of these parents, well, the social worker's on holiday. Oh, I don't think we could do that this side of Christmas, you know. So there's something really bad happening here. I want to nail my colours to the mast. And also, I think there's a wider pervasiveness that happens when workers don't feel empowered, don't feel that it's okay for them to make decisions about routine, sensible, safe things, because it gives the feeling that kids pick up that they themselves are somehow a risk object. You're not in a relationship with them. You're managing them as a source of risk. And that's terrible, say, in relation to routine outdoor activities. I hinted there that workers can sometimes become very defensive and say, particularly managers might say, it'd be great if we could have a programme of activities. And the lazy worker gets a lot of cover from this risk focus, because a lazy worker can go, yeah, I'd love to do that, but we just need to make a plan and get it signed off by the parents or do a risk assessment. So maybe we should just get out the Xbox again. Or maybe go to the cinema would be easier, 10-pin bowling. Because for some reason, we don't seem to need parental consents for 10-pin bowling or going to the cinema. And just from a professional point of view, why is that? Why would you need it to go to the beach? Well, it's because of all this anxiety about outdoor activities. So this whole culture that's emerging, that's happening, gives cover to the lazy worker. But I don't want to blame the workers. And I don't think, given this wider societal trend, we can't expect to point the finger, if you happen to agree with me, and say, it's the workers that must sort this out. They must take more risks and just go on with the job. Clearly, if this culture is embedded as it seems to be, managers need to give the lead, need to take the strain and say, yeah, head off on the minibus or just go out there and kick the ball about and we'll not worry about that. So I also want to point out to you that this issue I'm trying to bring into chart focus, isn't just me or one or two colleagues who've had the pleasure or the leisure to look into this issue. Actually, this issue of the dangers of overprotection, to use that phrase, has been recognised for a number of years, including by, in Scotland, our regulatory authorities. And part of what I'm saying here is that the regulators have tried to stem this tide. And in the care standards, the NCS stands for National Care Standards for Children's Homes, state you should enjoy safety but not be overprotected. So, it's in the standards, and further than that, our care commissioner, our inspectorate body a few years ago, they got fed up as people like me went around saying, I'm going to homes and centres where they say, we can't do this because the care commission says you can't. And you got stories very similar in the early year services to residential childcare. You get stories, you talk to early years workers, we can't take the kids to the garden because there's a hole in the fence and some of them might crawl out and that would be a risk. So we're not allowed to do that. We've put in a request to get the fence fixed, but we can't take the kids to the garden because there's a risk. And people are just completely in a completely disempowered state. But they've passed it on to the inspector. Of course, if you actually tried to track that down, almost certainly you wouldn't find a direct statement from the inspector saying, don't take the kids in the garden till the fence is plugged. It would be, you should get the fence attended to. But people interpret that because they're so on the defensive, so worried about falling foul of a regulator, that they then add in another stage. Okay, so a few years ago in Scotland, the care commissioner chief at that time, Ronnie Hill of childcare, he got something published. He overcame his own organisational barriers and put out a paper entitled "The Inspectors Wouldn't Allow It." And he talked about myths and fables, and he was getting angry. He was saying, "This isn't true. We're not the people to blame here." So. Just a little step aside here for the Scottish context. Because we had government support, because we had regulatory support, and because we had the presence of Celsus, we were able to push this issue. And then a big thing happened. Our Children's Commissioner got involved. And the Children's Commissioner was utterly shocked to discover the extremes and the kind of madness and the myths that were believed by many residential workers. And I've quoted one there that's causing humour. That there was one story. This is true. It's been told to me. It actually happened. It was a residential school. It was not Kibble, but it was another one in the west of Scotland, where a big teenage lad, the one sort of little constructive recreation they were getting him to do was pick up his interest in fishing. There was a little pond nearby. It was a wee lochan, as we would say here. But stupidly, but understandably, the workers just said to the social worker, "Hey, we're going to get him fishing." And social worker said, "Oh no, I'll need to get our outdoor regulations." And actually, if it's running water, if there's a, I think actually you'd need to have a safety rope for this kid. I mean, it was just mad stuff. And I don't want to stop at this point because I know that probably all of you are dying to jump in with an example of your own. And we could spend the rest of the time swapping absurd stories. But we've got to deal with this. We've got to get beyond it, is my view. Anyway, we got a bit of support in Scotland, so we got guidance as a result of the Children's Commissioner engaging with central government and local government. And we now have guidance from the government saying, go outdoors. And we've demolished all the myths. But is it going to work? I don't know. So just very quickly, you don't need parental consent for insurance purposes. We got a high-powered group together to develop these guidance. Guy from the Association of British Insurers. And we were going around the table just talking about how people believe you need to get parental consent because of insurance, would sometimes be said. And he just looked blank, because we all looked to him and said, yeah, so what does the insurance company go out and say? He said, I don't know what you're talking about. You all get insurance. That's not how insurance works. Organisations say what they do, and they get insurance for it. Whether a parent has signed a form or not doesn't affect insurance. You know, you all get insurance. You can't sort of stop getting insurance because somebody's not signed something. So we just demolished it. You know, that if you're in charge of the child, as a care worker or the team, whatever level you organise it at, you decide in that sense. So, I won't detain us with what is good practice. What happened in Scotland was that people got mixed up with good practice about talking to parents, informing them, working with them. That's good. But the idea that they need to take consents. Anyway, I'm going to skip some more bits here because I want to quickly, just at the very end, just say that British social workers and residential workers discovering social pedagogy. And one of the particular things it seems beneficial about is in this area of outdoor activities. And one of the examples you get when you talk to workers about what is the impact of doing social pedagogy training, short course training, is that people feel more confident about the value of doing outdoor activities and more willing to take responsibility. And so there's some examples there, and the references I'll give you at the end. This is a very detailed example of someone just talking about the extreme risk averseness that they had to do before they took kids paddling. But this was Essex County, I think this came from, and they went through quite a process, and the senior management owned social pedagogy, and they began to take responsibility and discovered there was no rule about you could only go in the water up to your knees. It was somebody believed that was the guidance and had acted on it. And they just said, we're not going to do that. We know how to take kids safely to the beach, so we're going to do that. And they did. So some of our social pedagogues in Britain are developing this notion of risk competence to try and counteract this and say, we can't have risk aversion, but we can have risk competence. And I'm going to skip through this, but basically based on children's developmental needs. That if children need to play, which we'd all agree, then playing, and in relation to my theme of outdoor activities, clearly is developmentally enhancing for children. Say, I don't need to debate that here. So actually, children need to learn within a context of play to take risks or to manage the risk of going on a bike or running through a field with some nettles. And that the job of the adult, as in a parent, is to help them manage risks appropriately. So if they're too young to know that is a field of nettles, you tell them or you stop them. And if they're old enough to know better, you let them find out and then discover what a docking leaf is for and all that kind of stuff. So in broad terms, we think about what's an unacceptable risk in terms of the child's stage of development and what's an acceptable risk. And for those particularly out with Britain, when we're doing stuff on social pedagogy, we love to use this photograph of this child sawing through a plank he's standing on. And I assure you, there's no correct answer, as you might imagine, but we just sometimes use it as a prompt, and we put it up for a couple of minutes and then say, people, what do you think about that? And as I say, the British folks are often having to reflect deeply on deeply troubling emotions when they face that photograph, and deep anxiety. They need to rush to rescue the child and sack somebody who's allowed the child to get hold of a saw. But we don't think that's a good idea. So my final slide really is about, having quickly gone through this big issue, but saying, why is social pedagogy helpful here, when maybe the Care Commission or even guidance provides some weight, but it's not really going to stop all this risk-averse practice on its own, probably. But what we think social pedagogy is helping, because it provides workers with a sense of theory, some respectable body of knowledge that helps them justify what they're doing, takes it away from being personal or idiosyncratic, as we might say, or individual to the agency, says, well, I'm a pedagogue. This is the kind of stuff I do. And there's a whole theory about child. But the crucial element, I think, and my thinking's continuing to develop, and welcome any comments or feedback on this line of thinking, is that one of the crucial things is that social pedagogues are trained to take responsibility for children's development through the relationship with them and the team. Whereas what's happened in Britain is that our untheorized social care, residential care, has not been able to resist the child protection agenda, which a whole lot of this anxiety about risk is set against wider child protection, that you must fill in forms and do procedures and get other people to sign things, because that keeps you safe. We all know that our British child protection system is not mainly about protecting children. It's mainly about protecting agencies. And, you know, well, maybe it does both, but it's driven by agency protection. So we haven't been able to fight that using most of our social work theories and discourses, and certainly residential care with the status issues. We haven't been able to resist it, but it does seem that social pedagogical framing and ownership can help people to move to a better place of care. So thank you very much. I think I shouldn't ask for questions because I think we're over time. Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, Leanne's dying to get in.
Sitting here, I just wonder whether you think there are any reflections we can gain from that seminal piece of work carried out over 50 years ago by Isabel Mingus about social systems acting as a defense against anxiety. Because it seems to me that much of what we're talking about in the illustrations you gave were about risk-averse anxiety, or anxiety that something might go wrong. So I then create a system, or I use a system that means I don't have to do anything. I just think these are not new, but we might well be able to further analyze what that's about.
I'll let others come in, yeah.
I'm just gonna say that it's the anxiety at the personal, at an individual level is not new. What seems to be new is the societal trend, and it's not just Britain, towards public management, new public management, neoliberal ways of individualizing social problems and institutionalizing structures that support such risk-averse ways of doing it.
And if we add the two dimensions of that and put supervisors and managers in that role, then their anxiety is also compounded, and we get a systemic and personal one.
Exactly.
I mean, I think you've both drawn out, indeed, that is connected. And I think the Isabel Menzies-Lyth stuff about containing anxiety is useful for revisiting in this and other areas. Partly, as I say, to give us a language to allow people to say, we know, to social workers or agency, you get a bit anxious, don't you, about us going to the beach. So let's acknowledge it. But the minister has said there is risks in everything. The head of the Care Commission has said you can't go through life without some accidents. So we do need to bring that and begin to own it and fight it back. Gareth, which come in.
Yeah, no, just we need to remind people that the COAC tools document is available on the SALSA's website. It's not in references there.
Thank you, Gareth. Yes. folk want to get access to this, they can certainly get it on the Celsus website and other places. So thank you very much.
Thank you.